Okay, today is Tuesday, May the 20th, and I'm sitting in the University Library with Ruth Messenger, the President and Executive Director of the American Jewish World Service, for an oral interview for the Philanthropic Studies Archives. This is Andrea Pachter speaking. It's a beautiful day here in Indianapolis. It's very sunny. So let's just make sure that that worked. All right, good morning, Ruth. How are you today?
Very well, Andrea. Thank you.
Well, good. What I'd like to do for the first part of our talk today is to run through a little bit of your personal experiences and then to focus specifically on your work with AJWS.
Okay.
So I'll kind of keep an eye on the clock and we'll go from there. You have a very interesting background, and I'd like you to give a brief synopsis of it, and particularly talking about that transition between politics and the time that you joined us in philanthropy.
All right. Well, I guess it'd be best to say that I've sort of never believed that you just have one profession that you pursue. So I had a lot of different jobs. I have a degree in social work. I did a lot of early community organizing. I worked for a community school that was set up by parents, and that's relevant because a great deal of what I did with that organization was to help it raise its first money. So I've been doing fundraising all along. As I got interested in issues in my community, the need for some obvious need for some changes, I began to look more and more at the people who were making the decisions that affected our community's life, and I think I was at that moment developed an interest in politics, and when the opportunity came along to actually run for local office, I seized it. It takes a while to get elected, so I ran a couple of times. When I held office, I became perhaps that much more focused on issues of funds and funding. First of all, you have to raise a lot of money candidate,
sure,
which is not easy because it's not tax exempt, and people aren't sure whether they want to invest in you. But I also got very interested in how the government at various levels budgets its money, how little money is available or how difficult it is for community groups that are actually making change to access public dollars and how hard it is for them as well to raise philanthropic dollars. So I would say that that interest was always there. When I was ready to leave government, which was because I'd served for 20 years and because I didn't need to do this, but I chose to run for mayor, knowing that it was an unlikely campaign running against an incumbent, a popular incumbent. So I had probably most of the year and a half of that campaign to be thinking about what I would do next, and based on my background and my interests, to be honest with you, I just assumed that I would run a not-for-profit organization. So I knew that from that point of view, I would be raising money. What only became clear when American Jewish World Service presented itself as a job opportunity is that I would not only be raising money, but dispersing money, mm-hmm, because we are a public foundation, so we raise now, used to be much, 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 much smaller, but now we raise $32 million a year, and we spend a little over half of that in grants to existing organizations in addition to the other programs that we run. So I've become a philanthropist, although it's a philanthropist of other people's money, which is different. Well, philanthropist, we take great care to raise the money to reassure our donors that their money will be well spent, and then to give it out carefully and thoughtfully. So that's a key component of the job, although I want to say that I am probably a little more focused on the broader substantive issues of the job. What is this organization? What are the challenges in global international development in the 21st century? How can I guess this next point is related to fundraising, how can I educate in my target community, which is the Jewish community in North America, the importance of doing global work? It's an educational challenge, but it's obviously also a fundraising challenge.
Tell us a little bit about your academic work, just for the record.
Oh, that. I attended Radcliffe College, which was the Women's College of Harvard University, which unfortunately doesn't exist as an undergraduate college. But it was basically a Harvard education. That's my BA. I majored in political science, not because I had any notion that I was going to end up going into government, but because it was a really good liberal arts major. And I then went to social work school, which was intentional, except that when I enrolled in social work school, I thought that what I wanted to be was a caseworker. And by the time I finished social work school, I knew that that was exactly what I did not want to be. But I had fortunately learned something about community organizing and something about education and management. And so I was able to take the skills that I picked up in graduate school and apply them in very different arenas of my life.
Through your life experiences, you probably have had a couple of role models. Would you amplify on one or two of them, people who influenced you in some way, shape, or form?
Sure. My most significant role model was my mother, for several reasons. My mother went very far in higher education for her age cohort. So she was a graduate of Bryn Mawr College in 1936 and did all her work except a doctorate for a degree in philosophy, wrote some papers, and was a student at what is now called the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's now called the New School University in New York. At the time that she went there, it was known, I don't know what its official name was, but it was known as the University in Exile because it was the teaching site for all of the distinguished academics who fled Nazi Germany. It was quite a dramatic story in the past. She studied with a major philosopher named Paul Weiss, who's written literally books. But then, through a variety of vagaries, which were not appropriate to this, they're in her oral histories, she got a job at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, which is the center for training conservative rabbis. But she was, actually what you and I were talking about before, she was their public relations radio and television specialist before that was really a field. And she
certainly not a field for women.
Right.
In those
but it
days.
Really wasn't a field. I mean, it was just whatever that guy's name is. What's his name? Who was inventing that field? I can't remember his name now. Some famous man. But it was, he was just doing that. So she was, like, figuring out how do you work with, in her case, it was religion editors. Mm-hmm. How do you get the story out? She's a person responsible for the annual, for many years, wrote the annual full-page ads that the seminary publishes at the time of the annual high holidays in the Jewish community that raised provocative, the ads chose to raise provocative ethical issues for the community. So she did all of that. I got to see her as a model of a working mom when most moms weren't working unless they had to see her as somebody passionately interested in everything from grammar to explaining activist role for Jews, the Jewish commitment justice. And she was a master of using time, never was known to do more than two things, and at the same time, and I inherited that and have built it occasionally as aggravating to other people.
It's her. Only because they can't do it themselves.
Oh, maybe. So I learned it from her, and I would say that she was the primary role model. Her father, my maternal grandfather, was also active, was also a serious scholar who loved teaching his grandchildren. So it was sort of a constant, I don't know what the comparison is, but sort of, you know, we were always being asked questions, tested as to what we knew, given and shown how to find out additional information. It was a great way, for me at least, it was a great way to grow up. And both my grandfather and my grandmother and both my parents were activists in supporting Jewish organizations with their philanthropy to some extent and with their time to a great extent. So that was another modeling opportunity. And then I would just say that fortunately later on in my life I was able to work with and learn from some distinguished people in politics, and also in one instance, very important, I've had a boss for about 6 years in one of the jobs I had who actually taught me that it's good for serious people to have a sense of humor.
I bet your mother and your grandfather had sense of humor as well.
Yeah.
Were there any particular characteristics, other than the ones that you've mentioned, that you rely on today that you learned from your mother and your grandfather, particularly in terms of philanthropy?
Well, that's very interesting. Yes, in the sense that it was a constant focus of discussion because they were, I didn't think to enlarge that, but in all this lay work that they did for Jewish organizations, serving on boards of major agencies like the Jewish Child Care Association, the part of something then called the Lakewood Home for Unwed Mothers. Mm-hmm. My father was literally on the board for, I think, close to 60 years of the Jewish Home and Hospital in New York.
Wow.
He was often the treasurer of that board. He was a CPA. But anyway, so all of that led to discussions about raising money, giving money, who the big philanthropists were, how people gave money, how people should be giving more money. So that all of that, yes. I would say, because I feel very strongly about this, that it struck me really only in the last, I guess I want to say, 15 or 20 years of my life as a fundraiser, that I don't think my family talks enough, and I don't think that most families talk at all about their commitment to give charity. So people, even people who are charitable givers, do it with their checkbooks late at night in consultation with each other, but they don't say to their kids nearly often enough, here's what we're doing, here's what we're choosing to sacrifice, which of course isn't common enough, but here's what we're sacrificing to give some money to a cause. We'd like you to be involved in thinking about what you'd like to do. So in the last 20 years, I've become very conscious both about talking to audiences about their own philanthropy and about modeling with our grandchildren the importance of giving away money.
And of course, the Talmud teaches that even the poorest of poor should give tzedakah.
Right.
So what I hear is that your parents and your grandparents, those generations, focused most of their conversation about philanthropy and tzedakah within the Jewish community. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes. Although I think they probably did have other charitable causes, but that's where most of the talk was about that. And again, they were not, and they surely did not see themselves as big givers. I think one of the challenges in many communities of philanthropy, both those people who are raising the funds and those people who are structured to encourage philanthropy, there's much too much of a division between, oh, the really big funders, and then these other guys who are regularly asked for money and very often are actually giving away a higher percentage of their annual budget and pushing themselves to be able to donate, I believe do not get sufficiently appreciated and therefore dialing enough of themselves and their own philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And by the way, as a consequence, this is not directly about my consequence, often don't give strategically because they think that what they do with their annual, who knows what, $10,000, dividing it up between and among charities, well, who cares? Well, everybody should care, and they should care most of all, but that whether or not they're really giving it to issues that got the most, whether or not they've really vetted the organizations that they're giving to. I think that there's a constant need for education of all people about the notion, actually the word philanthropy, because if you ask the average person on the street, without even by you, even where you have a distinguished center of philanthropy, I think they would tell you that Bill Gates is a philanthropist, but that they're not a philanthropist. But of course, they are a philanthropist. If they give away money, mm-hmm. that's philanthropy. And how do we help people think about this as a common and shared activity that everyone ought to approach strategically?
Given that you grew up in an environment that talked about philanthropy in a variety of ways, and that you've shared a little bit about the fact of this disparity, what's your personal definition of philanthropy?
I don't know if I could give it to you in one sentence, because I don't ever do it that way, but I'm attracted to the notion that the root of the word, love of human beings, concern for the other. I put a great deal of emphasis on the direct translation of the Jewish word tzedakah. For reasons incredibly irritating to me. Tzedakah is regularly defined in the Jewish community up and down the line, including by quote-unquote learned people who know better, charity, whereas the root of tzedakah is the word tzedek, which means justice. There's a huge, most powerful distinction, which is really what American Jewish service represents, between sort of giving people some money because you know what they need and maybe get it, or giving them goods, which is even worse because you know what they need, and helping create a more just world. Now, it may be the same money to the same organization. It may not be, but it ought to be thought about as trying to increase justice, economic equality, social equality, fairness in the world. And so a lot of my personal giving, like everybody. A lot of my personal giving is simply on a great deal of it. The majority of it is this a cause I want to support? Am I an appropriate person to be supporting this cause, given values? Am I helping to move the world toward justice? And of course, from my point of view, with my background, that's a reason to give a certain amount of money to candidates, which is not officially philanthropy because it's not tax deductible, but for me it certainly is philanthropy. It's taking my otherwise disposable income that I could dispose of for myself or my family and giving it to someone who's running for office, because I think that, because sometimes I'm really pretty clear they're not going to, but I think that they deserve to have the money to run a race and raise the issue, or even better, because I think that with enough funding, they have a chance of winning, and they are people who I believe will create nation, world.
You talked a little bit about the concept of tzedakah, which is core to the Jewish values. Tell us a little bit about how your religion informs your work.
Well, it's good that we started by talking about sort of family background, because I was kind of imbued in all of this without paying a lot of attention to it. The version of Judaism with which I was raised wasn't nearly so focused on which denomination and how many times you went to synagogue and exactly which rituals you observed. It was focused on living as a Jew, which meant caring about other people, giving something back, and working toward justice. And those ads of my mother's that I referred to, for example, she did the first ever full-page ad talking about why is environment a Jewish issue. She did the first ever ad that said there is domestic violence in the Jewish community. So all of these issues were about, so I just grew up with all of that. So my religion informed who I am and created me as a person concerned about social justice and doing for the other. And by the way, this is all interesting because my sister, I have one sibling, first to tell you that most of the religion stuff didn't take with her. She wasn't going to go to a bad Hebrew school. She wasn't going to stay. But she's a pediatrician. She's been a pediatrician for 35 years, and that comes clearly out of the same instinct and motive, and the way in which she shaped her practice and conducts her practice is entirely about taking care of the other.
In Judaism, we have the concept of tzedakah, which you've defined as justice coming from the root of tzedek. We also have the value of tikkun olam. Can you amplify on that just a little bit?
Sure. Although, you know, this is like now very ridiculous to me, but this has now become a controversial issue because you are correct. Today, in modern Judaism, there's a common reference to the term tikkun olam, or repair the world. American Jewish World Service take that very seriously. So for us, we make the point of saying the world is not only your own little world or your own Jewish community or just the Jewish world, it's the world. And that each of us has different circles of obligation, and that those circles of obligation, of course, should start with yourself and your family. For our community as a whole, they should include worrying about the people in the world who are today's worst victims of poverty, oppression. When I say there's some controversy to this, the popularity of this term, tikkun olam, which I think is incredibly important to make popular, is criticized by some scholars in the Jewish community. It comes out of ways in a couple of prayers where they would argue that it simply means that we're asking God to do God's part to help make the world whole. And so there's some controversy around the way in which it's being used or popularized as an idea that begs people to pay attention to the verses in which they function. But a very popular definition I take very seriously from the prayer in which it's most commonly found, the notion that in Judaism when you are asking God to do something, you're always supposed to recognize that you as an individual are God's partner, and therefore, if work to be done, you have to do some of the work yourself.
You've set the stage very beautifully in the personal journey aspect of our interview today about why you were so suited to become the president of American Jewish World Service. It seems that it really resonates within you, and it was probably just meant to be. It was beshert, we would say. So we're going to spend the next few minutes talking a little bit more about this organization, American Jewish World Service. I understand that it has four major components: grant making, volunteer service, advocacy, and education. The organization was founded, I think, in 1985. Mm-hmm. Did it start with this comprehensive approach? And if not, how were they added?
The organization started with the notion that those already were concerned about the state of the world. And that many of the large international relief organizations and faith-based that were doing good work in the world attracted Jewish donors, Jewish supporters, Jewish board members, Jewish staff, but no place was this work being done by Jews as Jews. So that was the impetus of the founder, was to create a Jewish organization, go out into the world, and that would raise money in the Jewish, go out and provide help and support, and do it in the name of the Jewish community. Pretty early on, they developed this notion of giving grants and began to hone the notion of giving grants to smaller grassroots organizations where you didn't have to go through layers of government, where you could find a group that was doing good work, where you could monitor that work carefully. But for sure, the focus of the organization, probably for its first decade, on grant making, much more than on any of these other bidder to work hand in glove with each other. The service component was added earliest. There was first a decision to occasionally send skilled professionals whose professional capacity and ability would, in a sense, enhance the benefit of the grant. If you give people a grant to increase education about disease prevention in their community, and then you can also send them a public health expert who can help them analyze health problems in this community, what are the most important messages to give out, how might we do this in a way that's most constructive. So our early volunteer corps was particularly organized around increasing the leverage of the grant by giving the grantee organization professional help that they wanted. We have never sent volunteers unless a group says they'd like a volunteer, because going back to our notion of how you make change in the world, we think that people in their own communities have a very clear vision of how to improve, what they want to do first, and we try to support those efforts. Okay. So then, as we started growing the volunteer corps, the sending of professionals, which is now about 120 people a year, we got a whole different notion of service. And that really comes from my background, even though I did not ever do the Peace Corps because I already had two little children. But my whole experience of sort of going someplace very different, being of service to others, that comes obviously from my family, from this orientation that no money, but you could give time, you could be on a board, you could go and volunteer for an organization. That was all part of personal philanthropy. So I had discovered in my life, and as I educated and raised children in their lives, that going someplace very different from the community you know and trying to figure out a way to learn enough about another culture to be able to be helpful was really valuable. So that led us at AJWS to start arranging service programs for mostly high school seniors and college students and students recently out of college, defining them as not having a professional skill to pass on, basically having muscles and some interest in being able to go do physical labor, but to do that, to get a sense of themselves as effective agents in the world, to get a sense of themselves as being able to do and give, the notion in the sense that you don't have to have money mm-hmm. to be able to do philanthropy or to care for others. And so we've developed a very substantial service program for young adults in the Jewish community, taking now probably about 300 people for everything from trips. And, by the way, surrounding that with a Jewish education, which talks about what does Jewish text have to say about this work, what does Jewish text have to say about these issues, but for sure, to come back to your appropriate theme, what does Jewish text have to say about giving? Mm-hmm. The notion that you raised before, that even the poor should give, mm-hmm. the idea that there are a lot of different ways to give. And I would say, so then that really explains the other two areas that we program work that we've developed, we then developed a serious educational department to provide the curriculum materials for these service volunteers so that our group leaders could be trained as to how do you talk about what the Torah says about forgiving debts and connect it up to the experience of a country in Africa that is waiting for debt forgiveness in order to have enough money to spend on the health care of its own children, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have really good curriculum materials that were initially designed and are regularly evaluated and redesigned for the participants in our service trips. But that curriculum, those curricula have become of interest to people running congregations, day schools, supplementary schools. So our education department is continuing to provide different kinds of learning and study materials, almost all around this broad theme of the role of Jews as global citizens. And then, in a similar fashion, we increasingly over the last 8 years, but particularly over the last 3 years, have developed an advocacy component to our work because, you know, we've grown from a $2 million to a $32 million organization. We give away a lot of money, but we don't give away money on the scale or on the size that the governments of the world do. And if the governments of the world, or let's just stay with our own government for a minute, gave more non-military foreign aid and targeted it better and provided some support for these grassroots energies where social change is really being made, then many of the problems that are grantees deal with, that we deal with on their behalf, would be alleviated. So actually the push for most of our areas of advocacy actually comes from our grantees on the ground. They'll ask us why there isn't more money, for example, to make antiretroviral drugs available in countries where, or in a world where 8,000 people a day die of AIDS. When we look with them at the money that is coming out of the U.S. government for that purpose, we'll both see that it's not always adequate in size, but quite frankly, we'll also see that it's very misdirected money. Evidence-based government philanthropy, it's much more to do with IEI. It doesn't really tackle the problems in the way they need to be tackled, and so that means that we have to have an advocacy department, and that we have to lobby on those issues, and I want to add this because it's important to me, that we need to, or we choose to, all of our donors, but I would say particularly those students with whom we work in our service programs, that if you really believe in tzedakah, if you really believe that you're trying to move toward justice, then not only is charity not enough, but hands-on service is not enough without also having an advocacy component. Now, have these four programmatic areas, and we spend lots of time trying to be sure that they work well in collaboration and synergy with each other.
Are there any other Jewish organizations that have the same mission?
No. That's an easy question.
Okay.
There are a great many Jewish organizations. The Jewish communities occasionally assume described as being an alphabet soup of organizations. I love some better than others, but virtually, not exclusively, virtually all Jewish, most Jewish organizations have as their primary or their primary and secondary concern the needs of Jews. The needs of Jews in a particular issue sometimes broadly distanced in Israel. Large Jewish organization, the American Jewish Joint, pays attention to the needs of Jews where they may be either poor themselves or victims of anti-Semitism or oppression. But we are the only Jewish organization that is related to and works on the needs of poor people in the world, not only at the time of a natural disaster, but on an ongoing. There are some other Jewish organizations now, I'm delighted to say, that are working on this issue of service, that are putting young Jews into service situations, whether in Israel, in the Jewish diaspora, elsewhere, or in communities in America, whether it's young people going to rebuild homes in preservation. But all of these issues, all of those programs, the Jewish service programs, should be encouraged. And from my point of view, they come under the broadest notion of philanthropy because they help meet the needs of others at the same time as they're benefiting themselves.
How does HAWS collaborate with Jewish and non-Jewish international religious humanitarian organizations.
Basically, our motto is we work with anybody. We're very interested in spreading information in the American Jewish community about the importance of doing this global work. So we'll look for a congregation or a federation that's raising money because they just said that there was a cyclone in Burma, to then talk with us about, if they give that money to us, here's what we'll be able to do with it, which in most instances is infinitely better, and I say this, than giving it to a large international relief organization. At the very least, if it's given to us, it will then be given on the ground in the name of the Jewish community. But more importantly, people are, I think, appropriately leery sometimes of giving to very large organizations that have very high overhead and where they don't really know what's going to happen on the ground. And we can tell people, and we do tell people, the way in which we spend your money is not going to change the future of El Salvador. But we can guarantee you that it will go to those farmers in this community who are suffering from that particular mudslide you read about, or who are on their own creating new economic empowerment opportunities for their citizenry. So in the 36 countries where we work, although we don't frown on the type of philanthropy that says this congregation gets to adopt that village, this person gets to help those four children, I think that that's, but we can tell people, here's the kind of work we're doing around the issue of women's empowerment. Here's the kind of work we're doing around agricultural improvement, places where we're doing it, and we can, you can definitely say that you want us to spend your money on HIV/AIDS or on microfinance. Yes, we partner with, partner with all of the non-Jewish, very often also faith-based institutions that are working after a disaster or in country or with a particular project that's a grantee of ours. Very high respect for collaboration. Everybody knows there's more work. One other mention, and that is this community does collaborate now very nicely in response to world disaster structure, so that after a tsunami or an ethnic cleansing or a cyclone, we can get groups together fairly quickly in the Jewish community. And so say if we raise money for the tsunami or for the victims of the earthquake in Pakistan, we will ensure as a Jewish community that we collaborate and talk with each other about how the dollars are going to be spent.
Does the American Jewish World Service collaborate with any Muslim organizations?
Yes, easily and comfortably. There are not very many yet national organizations based in America that are worldwide Muslim relief organizations. It's a community org having those structures and does have some such structures in other parts of the world. Where we most likely to collaborate with Muslim partners is on the ground, where, again, our grantee is not a Muslim organization, but the people in the community are Muslims. Mm-hmm. And so that is the religion of practice. And so by us being a Jewish organization helping a Muslim population, we're doing an unusual...
How often does the question arise about why an organization with the word Jewish in it reaches out to all people?
Oh, right, comes up pretty often. Since it's the essence of what we do, it's something that we talk about often in our presentation. So we talk about the Jewish sources that say, and sometimes very explicit, do this for Jews, and talk about it, and we pick out interesting parts of the Torah and the Talmud commentary and take people, anybody who's interested, but particularly the students that work with us, through a set of arguments to understand, well, what does Judaism really have to say about this? From a more practical point of view, it's a question I get asked probably in 80% of the audiences after I speak, and it's usually from somebody who's genuinely interested, wants to be a little bit provocative, and it's like, sort of, let me get this clear. You're a Jewish organization, but everybody you help is with non-Jews, and I mean, even here yesterday, somebody who, you know, was interested, had, was part of the group that invited me to speak, started his first question to me by saying, now, do you do any work outside of Israel? Well, we don't even work in Israel. So it's just it's a hard concept for people to get, but it's, since it's the essence of what we do, it's something that I really love to respond to and talk to people about. It's still a Jewish organization. It's structured along basic Jewish values, It's raising its money primarily, obviously not exclusively, but primarily in and from the Jewish community. And by the way, it's got an educational goal of educating about global responsibility in the Jewish community. And then we think as well that it's extraordinarily Jewish to be helping the people who are in greatest need, even though they are not Jews, and to be building those connections.
So you mentioned that HAWS does not work in Israel. Is that a thought about decision? I mean, what's the
Well, first of all, there are hundreds and hundreds of Jewish organizations that work in Israel. Some work very specifically to support the Israeli government. Some work to raise options for peace in the Middle East. Some work on challenges of coexistence between Israel and Palestine, between Jews and Arabs in Israel. It's like a way, it's like you don't need us to go do work that other people are doing. And in addition, informally, we've described our target as being the one-third of the nations in the world that the UN identifies as the poorest. Is that standard, and probably by almost any standard, a developed world country.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about the volunteer component, particularly focusing on the high school and college-age youth, but your volunteer program really expands through adults as well. Volunteerism is expanding all over the globe. Are there some unique characteristics you think for AJWS that you would be able to share?
Yeah, we don't do much tourism. We do more volunteerism. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a lovely concept, but as I look at some of these programs, I guess to be critical, I would say that it's sort of to let you take it around. It's just a little throwaway add-on to what you're doing. That's great for vacation. It's good to have a little bit of perks connected to your vacation, but that's not what we're talking about. So we are like, and there are many programs like ours, but just not many in the Jewish community, mm-hmm. but we're intensely focused on what is service to other people, what it means to not, assuming you have all the answers for them, you are not doing for them instead of doing with them. You are telling them what to do as opposed to showing them what to do and helping them learn. So as much as possible, certainly our student volunteers are deliberately going and working alongside villagers. And the villagers have to deal with the notion that we actually have women doing work. Rather dramatically, at every trip, even the one-week trips, there's like a second or third day where the students say, they could do this faster than we can, so what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. And like that's a great learning opportunity. Like, guess what? You at the University of Indiana are not highly skilled at digging holes and putting in fertilizer. What a big surprise. But nevertheless, there's a value because you're helping from a time labor point of view. There's a value because you're there learning. And there's a huge value because when these communities who've never been outside of their own communities are incredibly moved by the notion that there's a group of people.
How do you keep connected with the alumni of all of these trips?
Well, I would say initially that is certainly something we didn't think about. I mean, we thought, okay, we'll add them to our lists. Hopefully they'll want to stay connected to our work. There'll be good advertisements for our programs, and maybe they'll become donors. Fortunately, as we've grown our service work, we started first to think about this much more consciously, to set up, and of course the web allows us, listservs, and to try to engage our alumni in knowing what else is going on in the world. And then about 2 years ago, two of the foundations that are interested in this expanding field of Jewish service came to us and said, we will fund you to work with the alumni because our interest is being sure that whatever happens on these trips sticks to the greatest extent possible. And so that's been very, very rewarding. We have an alumni effort. We're doing another Jewish service program for young adults, one that places people in work in anti-poverty agencies. They're smaller than we are, but their program is a whole year-long program. So four cities where we have the highest concentration of alumni, we're basically going to those alums and asking them what they want to do. Same principle that AJWS uses in the developing world. We're saying to these 20-somethings, 30-somethings, well, what would excite you to do in San Francisco or in New York that would be connected to the experiences you had with us that would continue to make you an activist in and with the broad field of social justice and an activist in and with the chair designing the programs. And that's viable, and I think it's going to be a growing piece of...
I have been the HAWS leader since 1996.
98.
I suspect the time has gone very quickly. What changes have you seen in the organization?
Oh, it's just been staggering. I mean, I knew when I got there, well, actually, I shouldn't say that. When I first got there, I thought, this is an organization that's either going to collapse or it's going to build it up because it's just ridiculous. So I increasingly then had hope that we could sort of grow it and, as we, you and I have discussed before, add on some other aspects of our programmatic work. The actual experience over the last 10 years has been like chasing a tiger. I mean, this organization has grown so fast that the real internal challenge is staff and the board continue to have the structures that allow us to do our work, grow our work, think about our work, and remain flexible and committed to excellence.
Think of one or two accomplishments or challenges that really stand out in the last 10 years?
Well, I probably suggested this before, but for me, really growing the service programs and thinking about them and having them become, the good news is, you know, the message is always be careful what you wish for. So the good news is now that there are a lot of activists in the Jewish community in America that have now decided that service is the magic bullet. And they want to know, can I put tens of thousands of people to work? And the answer is no. So we're trying to explain to them it's not the magic bullet, it's a magic bullet. And we are not going to do it for everybody, but we are going to contribute our expertise on what we have as curriculum, what we do about it. So I would say that in many ways that's the most exciting piece of the work because it's a piece that's of personal great and growing and expanding and taking new shape all the time. Also very pleased with the fact that we are in the process of developing a thoughtful advocacy arm that will represent us in Congress, that will make us increasable in the American Jewish. By the way, I would say that, although we're just beginning to explore the parameters of this, Jews as a community and on human rights to programs of tolerance, to compassionate care for the elderly or children or whatever. And I say all of that to say that despite that fact, the members of Congress in the United States, particularly the non-Jewish members of Congress, think, oh, we're going to be a real trailblazer, not alone, because there are other such entities that are bringing other messages to Congress, but we're going to be the first one we are the first Jewish organization saying we're really concerned about it. Like a triple take on the part of a staff member in a congressional office. No, wait, I think it's all to the good in terms of how we're perceived and likelihood of our being able to be effective on some of these advocacy issues.
Well, even in these few minutes, you have demonstrated that you are a person with indomitable spirit and indefatigable energy. How do you keep it up? How do you keep up the momentum?
I actually, you know, I think that I get asked that question all the time. I really want to say that I think a whole piece of that is, a combination of physiological and characterological. It's the trait, you know, do you see the glass half empty or do you see it half full? I've always been energetic and determined. I do a lot at any given moment. I care a lot about a lot of things. I sustain myself a lot in politics, which is not such an attractive. By really thinking if I was going to devote this much time and energy to the challenge of being an elected official, which was time always in some tension with my responsibilities to my family, that I better do it well, that I better do it with some notion of hope and increasing the capacities for change, because otherwise, what do you tell your kids you're there working on, you know, 20 hours a day? So I really credit my children for sort of helping me focus an ethical center and an optimistic perspective on the world. I would say in addition that various problems that beset other people, perhaps from somebody who wants to be doing it. But I am who I am.